This special episode of the Secret Identity podcast features the Amazing Spider-Man 35 Years of Writing Spider-Man panel from this year's Terrificon.
Before we get started, does anyone want to get out?
The Human Torch was denied a bank loan.
This is all your fault, you.
Get that finger out of your ear. You don't know where that finger's been.
Why do you keep staring at me?
You have 20 seconds to comply.
God, clean, wholesome fun.
And welcome everybody to Secret Identity. This is Brian Letendry here as always with the lovely, the talented, the beautiful Matthew A. Herring. How are you today, sir?
I am doing well, basking in the glow of what was Terrificon.
Yes, Terrificon was, dare I say, terrific, Matthew, to use a poorly chosen pun. But we did have an absolute blast at Terrificon this year, right up until the time that your car broke down on the way home. But before we get to that, let's save that to the end.
Yes.
We just had a great time. This is year four for Terrificon now, because it was year one in a hotel.
Yep.
Year two. It was year two in the...
It was in Stanford at a hotel?
Yep, it was in Stanford at a hotel. Then it was at the arena at Harbor Yard.
Actually, there was one in between.
So this is five?
This is five, I believe.
Wow.
So there was one, yeah, there was one with no tornado coming up, or hurricane coming up the coast.
Oh, right, yes.
Then the next year was the hurricane coming up the coast. The next year after that was at the arena.
Yep.
And then
last two years at
Mohegan Sun. And it has just been, it just seems to be getting bigger and bigger, yet remaining very small and very, very friendly.
I think you hit on the important piece there, is that we, you know, we're in the era now of shows that just continue to expand until they sort of burn themselves out. And I think what our buddy Mitch Halleck has done with this show being set at Mohegan Sun now is found a great venue for the show, but he's also being very thoughtful and really just planning well for the type of guests that he brings in, that the emphasis still be on comic books and comic related stuff. And so this year we had a great mix of creators and celebrities, all of which were attached to comic book stuff.
Yeah.
So you had Katrina Law from Arrow, who my son and I were so excited to meet, and she was absolutely awesome. You had John Wesley Shipp, who, you know, we talked about last year and was there again this year, and he's just an amazing dude. We had Flash Gordon.
Yeah, Sam Jones.
Sam Jones was there. We had Tony Todd, who did the voice of Zoom in the last season of The Flash. He was there. So great celebrities. We had Carmen, and I cannot pronounce her last name, but she plays Selena Kyle on Gotham.
She was a couple booths away from us.
Yep.
And then around the corner was the guy who plays Abraham on The Walking Dead.
Michael Cudlitz?
Cutlitz, something like that.
He was there as well. So great celebrity guests, but also just a wide variety of fantastic creators. Lots of our friends were there this weekend. And on top of that, you and I got to do a bunch of different panels. We did our usual sort of podcast panel stuff, and you did the Doctor Who panel as well. But then we were very fortunate to do some panels featuring creators. You had mentioned on the last show that you did a Women in Comics panel you moderated. You also were lucky enough to moderate a panel on Captain America with Roger Stern.
We did a great panel just going through the history of Captain America. And had a great time. And he is somebody that I've never spoken to him before, so I didn't know what to expect.
Right.
This is a guy that is just full of great stories, loves the characters he's worked on. I saw that when I didn't quite see it with the Captain America panel, because you're not really looking for that. But there was a spark there when he spoke. And then when I was sitting in on your Spider-Man panel, you saw that spark with him as well. This is a guy that is so excited about everything that he has done.
Right. And I have to give a huge shout out to Mitch, because he knows that I'm a huge Spider-Man fan, and he made sure that when there was a Spider-Man panel that was happening this weekend, that he, you know, gave that one to me to moderate. And so I got to moderate the Amazing Spider-Man panel, which featured a Mount Rushmore of Spider-Man writers. You had Peter David, you had J.M. DeMatteis, you had Roger Stern, and you had Dan Slott.
Yep.
Now, for me, when I say Mount Rushmore, like, that is again, we don't get starstruck very often, but I was so nervous about this panel and just so excited to have four of the greatest Spider-Man writers of all time, including the guy who's currently writing Spider-Man and writing some of the greatest stories ever. It was awesome. And so I had a list of about 20 questions, because you always want to have your backup questions in case there's not, you know, enough time, or in case you have too much time or whatever. We had 45 minutes for this panel, which for these four guys is just the tip of the iceberg.
Yeah.
We could have had a 3-hour long panel. However, what I will say is that all four of them were completely awesome. You had mentioned in the last episode that we like to go around and meet people beforehand. And so I had met and interviewed Dan Slott on a few occasions before this one, but it was great to see him again. And we did do an interview, which you'll hear in an upcoming episode of Secret Identity, but I had not met Roger Stern before. You and I met him on the first day of the show. I had met Peter David about 8 or 9 years ago at United Fan Con in Springfield, Massachusetts, and he remembered that show when I went over and I said hi to him. But I had not met Mr. DeMatteis before, and I had not met Mr. Stern before, and I refer to them as Mr. DeMatteis and Mr. Stern and Mr. David and Mr. Slott, because they, to me, are like people that I look up to.
Yeah.
And so when you talk about storylines like the death of Jean DeWolf, when you talk about Kraven's Last Hunt, when you talk about Who Can Stop the Juggernaut, when you talk about everything Slott has, Spider Island, you know, Big Time, Ends of the Earth, and all of that stuff, like, for me, it was awesome to be able to just be up there and listen to those guys talk. And so we didn't even get through a ton of questions, because the answers that they were giving to the questions were so great that I was like, just sat back and was like, by all means. And so what you have is, you know, a bunch of questions where each of them are giving an answer to that particular question. And then at the end of this, you'll hear that there were a couple of fans that had questions as well, but so much fun. And just one of my favorite moments of us doing Secret Identity was being able to be up there and listen to these guys.
And for me, who doesn't like panels, I don't like to go to them. I love to moderate and I love to do that stuff. I just don't like to sit through them, because to me, it's like, all right, this is an hour, or in this case, 45 minutes, where I could be doing something else. But I was so proud of you. I was so excited. Steve Barker, our good buddy, was there.
Who is also a longtime Spidey fan. And what I loved about having our buddy Steve there is that he is not a huge fan of the more modern storylines in Spider-Man. He is definitely one of those people that when the Mary Jane and Peter Parker marriage thing happened, like, he is out.
Yeah.
But has a ton of reverence for, you know, Peter David and Roger Stern and J.M. DeMatteis and stuff. So for him to be able to see those guys up there with the guy who's currently writing Spider-Man now, it's just like, you don't ever get to see that. And you never get to have those moments where those guys are all kind of playing off of each other and stuff like that. And so it's hard to tell whether or not things went well when you're the one moderating the panel.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because you're just in the moment. But it seemed to have been pretty well received. I'm going to put a link in the show notes to an actual video recording of this panel if you want to see these guys up there talking about the stuff that they're going to talk about. This, of course, is an audio podcast, so you're going to hear the audio that is from this panel. But I will put a link in the show notes, because there was a bunch of different podcasts and outlets that were there, and this was recorded on video as well. But just a huge thrill for me, one of my favorite moments of doing Secret Identity, and just an absolute great time. And so, as I mentioned, you'll hear the interview with Dan Slott somewhere down the road, but this features all four of them talking about Spider-Man and writing a book that means so much to so many people.
And we also have to mention, too, that Joe Caramagna slipped in.
He not only did he slip in, he specifically came because I was telling him, like, I'm really nervous and stuff like that. And Joe was like, oh, you know, I'm going to come and check out the panel. And he sat in the front row. And it's always great to have friendly faces in the crowd, because you know, you get a little bit nervous up there. And I just, you know, can't say enough about how great Stern and DeMatteis and David and Slott were. They were all wonderful.
Yep.
And I made sure to go around and thank them afterwards, because it's that was just a whole heck of a lot of fun. So if you're a Spider-Man fan, I think you'll enjoy this. If you are a process fan or a writer, I think you'll enjoy this. But even if you're not even interested in Spider-Man, I think that there's a lot that you'll get out of this. The audio, I would say, is pretty good overall. Again, we're recording in a big room, but I think that the voices come through loud and clear for all four of them, and for me too, who's asking the questions there. So hopefully everybody can hear what was going on, and the background noise isn't too bad, although you'll hear people milling around in the hallway and stuff, but it's worth a listen.
Because do you hear the Joker, by the way? Stuff. Is that in there?
Do you know what? I did not edit that out. I didn't edit this panel. And so this is the audio from the panel that we were there. And so there is a point in the middle where the Joker comes through, and Peter David's reaction is priceless to that. So that maybe was one of the top three moments of that panel. So it was really good.
It definitely was one of my favorites. And my Dan Slott 7-Eleven story is the one that kills me. That one, I'm sitting there laughing at him. And then crying because that was me.
But then the other thing that I think about too is, like, when you think about a character like Spider-Man, and, you know, I know we hear and we talk a lot about there's this whole, like, creator-owned comics thing versus writing for the big two and writing somebody else's character versus writing this kind of thing. Even as someone who loves creator-owned comics and would love to have my own creator-owned comic out there someday where I could make a name for myself in the comics industry, like, there are a handful of characters that if I was ever given the opportunity to write even one story for, I would not hesitate to take that. And I feel like Spider-Man is one of those characters for many, many, many comic creators. And so when you think about the fact that all four of these gentlemen were not only able to contribute to the history of this character, but were able to contribute stories that are now looked back upon as some of the greatest Spider-Man stories ever told. Like, that's pretty freaking awesome to say that you wrote Spider-Man and have people react to the stories that you wrote in a way that that is just forever.
And with the four up there, you probably, I would guess maybe 2.5 generations of Spider writers up there. Because
sure.
a couple of them were, you know, overlapped each other. But you had them, and all four of them that you'll hear, all four of them basically have the same story of how they got into it, what they think about the character, which to me right there was another one where I'm like, man, I really wished I didn't miss the Spider-Man wagon like so many other people that just love Spider-Man, because these guys are talking about just their stories. And, you know, oh, I got into Spider-Man with this one. And then they're all rattling off. Steve was next to me. Oh, that's issue 48. That was 48. That's 48. I'm like, is this what I sound like at panels or when I'm talking about comics? So you see and hear a lot of love for the character, which in a cynical world that we live in, it is so nice to hear that these guys are all, they love what they did. They're proud of that.
Well, and the other thing too, and then we'll sort of let the panel go so people can hear it. But behind a lot of the cynicism, you know, it's easy to forget too that people become so jaded and they become so negative, especially online, about a lot of this stuff. And most of the time, it's coming from a place of being passionate about the character. They're so invested in this particular character or this incarnation of that character or this take on this character that when it inevitably changes, when something happens that they don't, that's where that kind of comes from. And then some people are able to roll with that and just move with the new stories, and some people are not. But a lot of that comes from the fact that people... these characters do resonate with people in that way. And we all have our favorite characters that we, you know, knew and read and saw growing up. And for me, that character was Spider-Man. Mm-hmm. And so this was a real treat for me. Again, thanks to Mitch. Thanks to everybody at Terrificon. Thanks to these four creators. So hopefully you will enjoy this Spider-Man panel. And we will be back again with your regularly scheduled program with the next episode. So for Mr. Matthew Herring, this is Brian LaTenry signing off. Have a great rest of your week. And we will talk to you in a few short days.
Bye-bye.
Spidey is a character, I think, that resonates with people in a different way than a lot of the other comic book characters out there. And in a second, I'll kind of mention why. But, of course, today, we are very fortunate to have with us Dan Slott, Peter David, J.M. DeMatteis, and Roger Stern. So please give them a big hand. When when it was announced that we were going to be doing this panel here at the show, I put a post up on the Facebook group for Terrificon, and I asked people, you know, just to kind of give some thoughts about Spider-Man as a character and why the character resonated with them, because I think that that's the one thing about Spidey fans is we all have a story of why Spider-Man became one of our favorite characters or at what age he clicked with us, you know, whether it was Spider-Man and his amazing friends or it was the old appearances on the Electric Company or the comics were the first place that you found your way in. But once you do, you kind of become a Spidey fan for life. And there was a guy who posted on the Facebook page, and I'll just read his answer real quick. His name was Michael. He said, "For me, what's been so special about him has been his struggles, his difficulty in balancing guilt over his uncle's death, his worries over his aunt's health, his poverty, his studies, his personal life, his job at the Bugle, his friendship with Harry, his issues with girls, and being Spider-Man. He's a kid that's been bullied, a kid that has seen good men like Captain Stacy die, a kid who has lost a girlfriend, a kid whose best friend has succumbed to drugs, a hero that has to spend each and every day dealing with false perceptions of him generated by his employer, and yet still he presses on because he realizes that with great power comes great responsibility, and he does it all with a sense of humor. Pretty amazing." And so I thought that was a nice sort of way to encapsulate the way a lot of us feel about Spider-Man. He is a special character to all of us, and so I think the first question that I wanted to throw out to you gentlemen today was, for your runs on Spider-Man or your first experience writing the character, was he a special character for you before you started working with him? And if not, did he become that over the course of the time that you spent with him?
Yeah, more or less. Spider-Man was sort of the character that got me into reading Marvel Comics. I was, when I started reading comics, there were no Marvel Comics. I think there were Atlas Comics, but we had bad distribution in my area. And I read comics up through junior high school, and I bought into the lie that we had junior high school, that we don't read comic books anymore, even books with words but no pictures. Okay. And in high school, a buddy of mine said, "Well, you know, my older brother is in college and he reads these Marvel comics." Really? I hadn't heard of those. So I went to the drugstore, which is where we bought comics in the Midwest, not the only place you could find them. And Spider-Man, was it 40, I think. It's the second part of the reveal of the identity of the Green Goblin. I didn't know who Spider-Man was, I didn't know who the Green Goblin was, but by the end of that issue, I did, and I wanted to read more. And it took me about 5 years to find the previous issue, but it was worth it. 5 years, because there were no comic shops. There were no comic shops. You had to go to used bookstores and flea markets and things. Yeah. It was crazy. Didn't know internet. So, around that time, I also discovered that Marvel was doing Marvel Tales, which every issue you got a classic Stan Lee and Steve Ditko story, and I looked at this and I went, "This is a guy who used to draw Captain Atom. I remember that from the Trumpton days." And I also discovered in the early issues where he was in high school, he had a burr haircut and glasses, and I was in high school and I had a burr haircut and wore glasses, and I'm going, "Oh my God, it's me." And when I looked at the newer ones where he was in college, drawn by John Romita, and I thought, maybe by the time I'm in college, I'll look like I was drawn by John Romita. Didn't work. But I was sucked into this whole universe, and there were the Lancer paperbacks, and little by little I was able to backfill what had happened with Spider-Man, and I was going, "Wow, this is amazing." You know, and this Stan Lee guy really knows what he's doing. I can't wait to read what this is going to happen next issue. And, you know, about not quite a decade later, I was writing Spider-Man. I'm going, something is seriously wrong here. Stan Lee should be writing Spider-Man. Why am I writing Spider-Man? So I tried to do the best job I could to do the character that they've done, you know, a few years later.
And you did. You know, this is what you just said. It's interesting because I often think if I go back in time and find my 12-year-old self and say, "You're going to write Spider-Man," he would just faint. He would completely faint. You know, I think it was sort of a given when I was growing up reading comics that everybody read Spider-Man and loved Spider-Man, but there were other characters that I loved more and kind of took in my heart more. And as all these guys will probably agree, when you write a character, it's very different than when you read a character. And that's when I really fell in love with that character, when I realized that Peter Parker is probably the most three-dimensional, real, deep, interesting human character in all of mainstream superhero comics. And that's what he became for me. He became a very, very real person. And it sounds strange, but to this day, I think of him more as my friend than as a character. I'm very grateful for the royalties that built my house, all those things. He's been very good to me, you know? But and also, it's funny because that Spider-Man story you mentioned was actually the first one I ever read.
Oh,
also.
Really?
And it remains my favorite Spider-Man story of all time. But yeah, so for me, I always liked the character, but I fell in love with the character when I started to write him. And it's the same thing, even with the supporting cast, it always sounds funny. I said, when I fell in love with Aunt May, but, you know, Aunt May to me was always this sort of annoying old woman when I was reading the books. But when I started to write her, I saw all these other dimensions to this character and who and what she really was. And that's the joy of writing these characters versus reading them for us, is that we can discover new layers and levels. And it's all very personal. I would bet that for everybody on this panel, we have a very, very personal connection to Sue. Said, that's me. I've talked to Jewish writers, Catholic writers, atheist writers, whatever your background is, whatever your culture, there's something in Peter that we all hook into. And for me, coming from a background of both Catholic and Jewish guilt, I totally always agree with that. But I think that everybody does. There's something very universal in Peter that really resonates. So, and again, for me, I really discovered that writing the character versus reading the character.
I actually first started getting into Spider-Man as a result of the cartoon series. The one in which Spider-Man, where they had long shots of Spider-Man swinging through the skies with his web attached to, you know, clouds. Never figured that out, because there was like the Empire State Building, which was, you know, like at the time the tallest building in Manhattan, and Spider-Man goes swinging by, and you're just kind of wondering, what the hell is webs are attached to? And that started getting me into Marvel Tales, which was the, as Roger mentioned, the reprint book. And I was reading those just out of curiosity to supplement the TV series. It's basically the same way I discovered Superman.
Yeah.
Really, because I got into Superman because of the George Reeves TV series.
Absolutely.
And I still remember that the issue of Marvel Tales that really hooked me into Spider-Man was the climax of the Master Planner story.
Yes.
The one where Spider-Man is trapped under this massive pile of junk, and he has to lift it off of himself so he can get to the formula to cure Aunt May. And I just love that. I mean, to some degree, I feel like we've still all been spinning our wheels ever since that story came out. Because if no other issue of Spider-Man had ever come out, that would have been the definitive story. We're done. And as a result, that got me into start reading the ongoing monthly title. I started right around the end of the first Silvermane story.
Oh, yeah.
That, you know, which ended wonderfully. That was a great story. And I've just, you know, been into the character ever since. I mean, I really can't define what it is about Peter Parker that really pulls me in, aside from the fact that he's just living his life the absolute best that he can. And really, when you get down to it, that's all any of us ever do. I mean, when you think about other superheroes, you think, who's Batman? Well, he's this crime fighter who does this. Who's Superman? He's a superhero who does that. And we say, who is Spider-Man? You say, well, he's this guy named Peter Parker. You think about him first and foremost from his personal identity rather than his costumed identity. And that, to me, is probably what makes him more or less unique, you know, in the superhero world.
Wow. Like Peter, I came into Spider-Man through the 67 cartoon. If I got on my bike at school and I biked as fast as I could from when school got out, I was in time just, you know, running through the door, not saying hello to anyone, turning on the TV. I got to watch Spider-Man for a half an hour, and then I got to watch Adam West Batman. It was that, and those were my guys. And I didn't care about, like, any other superheroes. Like, eventually my cousin would give me comic books to read. And the first comics he gave me to read were the Galactus trilogy. That's how he started. But like, they weren't comics I owned. Those were in his basement and they were his. And one day I'm biking home from school, and by the 7-Eleven they had a big John Senior poster of Spider-Man in the window that said Spider-Man was coming to Stockton, California to that 7-Eleven to sign comic books. and I had to meet Spider-Man. I was the right age. I was a little Jewish boy, didn't get the Easter Bunny, didn't get Santa, but I was primed. Spider-Man was coming to my town, and I was going to see him. And I went inside and asked, like, how do I meet Spider-Man? And he's going to sign comics. And I'm like, how do I get the comics? And the guy pointed to a spinner rack. And I'd been in that 7-Eleven a million times buying candy or whatnot, and I never noticed it. I'd always walk past it, but the minute he said it, it was like a light hit it. Just like Ave Maria.
What was weird was the angel chorus.
So I went home and I bugged my dad. I didn't have an allowance. Yeah. And he said he would, and I said, I need money. I need to buy comics so I can meet Spider-Man. And he started me on allowance. He, of a quarter.
See, mine would start me on the psychiatrist.
He started me on allowance of a quarter, and he boarded me an extra quarter so I could buy two comics for Spider-Man to sign.
12 cents.
Yeah. No, a quarter. For me, it was a quarter. And
you
got
12 cents a comic.
I got, for me, I was 25 cents only on the, when I was there.
Oh, okay.
And, I got an issue with, I can't remember it, it was a Marvel Tales issue, so it's not the Spider-Man number, but it was where he fought Electro inside the theater, and he got his costume burned off by the end of it, and he didn't get the money he was promised for appearing on the late night talk show. Oh, yeah. And another one with the Marvel team-up where he teamed up with the Beast to fight the Griffin. And when I read these, it resonated to me so much because he lost. Like, I read the comics, and they clearly ended. And Spider-Man came out worse than he started at the beginning of the story.
Yep.
And I didn't... My brain couldn't comprehend that because Batman would win. Superman would win. Spider-Man lost. And I walked in reading every Spider-Man comic from that point on, worried if Spider-Man would win by the end of the comic. And that's what resonated to me about him. I lost in my daily life. I didn't get to achieve everything I wanted to do. You know, I wanted to. Some people would tell me, no, you can't. And then you'd be like, oh, you do the little Charlie Brown walk home. But that was Spider-Man. Spider-Man was like me. He couldn't get things done. He was a wreck. He was a schlub. And that made me care about him so much. I went and I got, you know, I met Spider-Man. And I stared at him, you know, until it was obviously uncomfortable for him. And then I left. And I was like, those comics were destroyed within 2 days. Because I just reread them so many times. And like you guys, when I was reading it, it was like Ross Andrew was doing Spider-Man. And I could read the Ross Andrew, Gil Kane-ish era. I could read in Marvel Tales. I could read John Senior. And the Pocket comics were coming out. So I could read three eras at Spider-Man at the same time. And there were certain things that didn't hit me. I didn't realize in the current books that Captain Stacy wasn't around. It never dawned on me. And here he was in my Marvel Tales. And... you know, he hadn't met him yet in the Ditkos. Yeah. And then I hit the Marvel Tales that was ASM 90. And it destroyed me as a child. And I was crying. I was reading this. And to this day, that's my favorite Spider-Man comic, is the one where Captain Stacy dies. Because he knew, the whole time he knew, it was Pete Ross and Spider-Man that whole time. And he knew. It was terrible. I love that. I had a thing where I was doing a signing in like your neighborhood, New Jersey, and this little boy comes up in a Little League uniform, and his dad's with him, and the signing is like, and he's like we came straight from the game, he had to meet you, his favorite book is Superior Spider-Man, he is loving Superior Spider-Man, he had to meet you, and the kid, and I'm talking to the kid like, what do you like about the book? And we were up to like issue 9 had just come out, and the kid's like, his favorite thing was Ghost Pete. And he wanted to know, he was rooting for Ghost Pete, and he wanted to know how Ghost Pete was going to win and how he was going to. And all 8 issues are beaten up. They've been read a million times, and I get to issue 9, and it's pristine. And I go, I'm like, have you read this yet? And he's like, I just bought it in the store. And I just kind of sign it and give it back to him. And then they went through the line again. And the little boy comes up to me in his Little League uniform, and his eyes are watering, and his lip is quivering, and his dad's like, you can say it, you can ask him. He's like, it's Mysterio, right?
It's a trick, right? Ghost Pete's okay. And I'm like, no, it's not Mysterio. It's not the chameleon. It's not a trick. Ghost Pete's gone. But then I started telling him how I read Amazing Spider-Man 90 and how it made me cry. And sometimes bad things happen to good people. And then they get angry. And the dad's like, he'll be okay.
And they walk him off. They're just like, no, no, am I done?
But you talk about that loss, you know, and those challenges and that Parker luck and all of those things that we see of ourselves in Spider-Man and in Peter Parker that sort of compel us to continue to see what plays out in his life. As you were all, you know, going through your runs and your different experiences, even in different books with the character, like, for was it A, hard to strike that balance between his personal struggles and the big stuff that he deals with as Spider-Man, and which of those was more fun for you to write? Did you enjoy writing his day-to-day challenges in his job with you know, his supporting cast, or versus the big fights, or like, which one of those did you sort of gravitate toward more?
Well, they were equally important to me. Mm-hmm. And I was lucky starting to write Spider-Man, we got more pages, because for a long time they'd been carving pages out of the stories, so that we're down to like 17 pages at one point. And some of my predecessors' solution was to downplay the Peter Parker stuff and do more Spider-Man stuff, more action. And finally, like, we reached a point where he said, no, we're going to have pages back. You know, the prices were going to go up. And he says, if prices are going to go up, we need to give them more story. And I think we gained like 5 pages. And I might have added half a page of action to the Spider-Man stories, but the rest was all Parker stuff, all the supporting cast, because it's, Pete, as we were saying, he's Peter Parker, you know. And with Spider-Man, even in my younger years reading it, I wanted to find out about Pete's life as much as Spider-Man's life. The balance was very important, and we got the extra pages. We got more Pete. This was great.
We recently went from 22 to 20, and I talked to Captain Mark Waid, said it's like a phantom limb. It's like, it hurts. You need those 2 pages. You want them so bad when you're plotting out your story.
Especially after years of being used to this page, and suddenly you have 2 pages less, and you're going, smaller panels?
Yeah. Artists love that.
Yeah, I mean, going with what you're saying, it's like there's no division in my brain between I'm writing Spider-Man action now and I'm writing Peter Parker. It's all Peter Parker. And I'm one of those guys, it's unusual in that I've done this for most of my adult life, writing superheroes. The thing I'm interested in the least is the superhero action in many ways. And the superhero action only matters to me in so much as it illuminates the characters, you know? To watch an action scene just for the sake of watching somebody drop a building on somebody else's head is boring to me, as the third act of many superhero movies, you know, makes painfully obvious. You know, they very often you get a great movie and you're 2/3 of the way through, and the last third is just people blowing things up and hitting each other on the head without anything that means anything to the characters. Which is why, for me, one of the stories that I enjoyed the most doing was a 2-year run on Spectacular, which was all about Peter and Harry. Well, Peter was Spider-Man and Harry was the Green Goblin, but it was about Peter and Harry. So when they had the costumes on, what mattered was that it was Peter and Harry underneath those costumes. It didn't matter that they were punching each other so much, although Sal Buscema could draw that better than anybody. What mattered was the people underneath those masks.
Oh, when you have that sequence where they're all just eating at the table, it's the creepiest thing in the world. It's so good.
I probably did the only superhero, supervillain dinner scene, right?
Yeah, that was great.
No, I actually did a superhero, supervillain dinner scene in my 8th issue of Supergirl. 20 pages of Supergirl and a demon and her parents sitting around having dinner. And the parents, of course, had no real idea what the hell was going on. But Leonard Kirk was the penciler, and he did a wonderful job with it. He actually mentioned pulling that off. I think it was Leonard. Maybe it was somebody. It wasn't. It was Gary Frank. Okay, never mind. Gary didn't want to be out there. I know I'm the one who said that, you know, Peter, you know, Spider-Man is Peter Parker no matter what. That said, I do really enjoy writing the fight scenes, mainly because I think that Spider-Man has hands down
the best rogues gallery in comic books.
Yes. Yeah.
The only one, the only other character who comes close is the Flash. And even with the Flash, you kind of wonder about the rogues gallery, because how in the world is Captain Cold able to pull out his gun and shoot at the Flash? Because Captain Cold will start to go, "It's the Flash!" And before he can get the sentence out, his ass is in jail, because he's the Flash!
There's this one Flash story, that's the one that broke it for me, where I had that realization with everybody as a kid, where he's fighting the Pied Piper. And the Pied Piper reaches for his flute, and then the thing that his flute was doing in that episode, something is doing it backwards, and now he's being attacked. And he's like, "How do you do it?" And the Flash goes, "I'll tell you how I do it." And you see how, before he even gets to the flute, he grabbed the flute, he ran back to the police lab, he undid it all, he put it in all backwards, he put it back in his hand, and I'm like, that's insane! Why would you put all that extra effort and put him in jail?
Superman did the same kind of thing, too. He did these incredible, "Well, how did I do this? I flew back through time." And then, you know, sometimes you got the feeling that Superman, the Flash, and these guys made things deliberately harder just to keep themselves entertained.
Yeah, they just fucked. Like they meet him later and go, "Here's how I fucked with this guy. I totally messed with his head. It's really funny."
Right, but, you know, Spider-Man, to my mind, has the best rogues gallery, and I have loved writing characters like the Vulture and Sandman and Mysterio. Mysterio was great because I wrote this issue that was supposed to be a two-parter, and I convinced them to get Todd Nauck to draw it, and they weren't interested in having Todd Nauck draw it. Their attitude was like, "Oh no, Todd Nauck, we don't like him." And I was going, "Give him a freaking chance." So they said, "Fine." And I was going to do this two-part Mysterio story, and I get a call from the editor, and they're going, We've started getting pages from Todd already." And I went, "Yeah." And they said, "They're coming in really fast." And I went, "Yeah." And they said, "And they're really good." And I said, "Yeah." And they said, "Could you make it a three-part Mysterio story?" And I went, "Okay." And I wrote in a third Mysterio. It was originally going to be two Mysterios in it. I put in a third Mysterio just to get a third issue in. And they wound up loving Todd so much, they then brought him back to make him the regular penciler for the rest of the year as a friendly member of Spider-Man. So I was really pleased about that. But, you know, the character, the villains are tremendously entertaining. When I do Spider-Man 2099, I find myself more writing stories that are about Miguel and his cast. I find that the characters drive the stories much more than it did for my Peter Parker stories. Because Miguel's, you know, villain cast isn't bad, but it's nowhere near Peter Parker's group.
Yeah.
For me, like, we're all in agreement about the dichotomy and how it's fun to do both. One of the things I like about Spider-Man more than any other hero is the quips. It's the fact that, you know, Batman's just fighting people and punching people and being clever. Spider-Man, he's doing like a stand-up routine. And he, for him, the humor is a superpower because he's using it like a Swiss Army knife.
They did that when, in an early issue, when he was fighting the Green Goblin. Mm-hmm. And the Goblin says, "Will you shut up? I can't concentrate on what I'm about to do." And Spider-Man immediately says, "Wow, I have a power I didn't even know I had. My spider speech."
Yeah, no, but it's like he uses it on so many levels. He uses it to calm civilians, to keep them at ease. He uses it to rattle the villains. He uses it to, like, bolster himself.
That's the big one. He said that specifically, that he makes jokes at everything to keep himself calm.
I did a bit in one of the stories where it clicked back to, like, the whole origin sequence. It clicked back to the whole Uncle Ben is still recently dead. And a lot of times Spider-Man is cracking jokes. And one of the things Paul Jenkins did, which I loved, was that he showed this relationship that he and Uncle Ben had playing pranks on each other. You saw where the humor just didn't come out of left field.
Right.
And one of the bits I did is, because he always has this internal monologue going, is I had the internal monologue going, "That's like, I'm doing this to crack you up, Uncle Ben."
Yeah.
Like, so you're up there, I want to make you laugh.
Yeah.
Is another reason. So it's there's millions of reasons why he does these kind of jokes, and no other hero is like that. Or if they are, they're imitations of Spider-Man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's something I love doing. Only Peter would fight a villain this way. Mm-hmm. Sometimes, like, you know, when you're interacting with fans, whether it's here or online, people are like, you don't understand Spider-Man. He does this because of that. No, he does things for so many different reasons. You can do a story where Peter Parker, the Spider-Man part of his life, is destroying his Peter Parker life. Where, oh, his life would be so great if he wasn't Spider-Man. And you can do the converse, where his Peter Parker life is so bad, and oh, when he gets to put on those web shooters and swing through the skies, it's a relief. It's here, oh, I get to be Spider-Man. That you can, there's so many millions of ways to play it and have it still be Peter. And that's great too. He's so versatile.
So another question that I had for you guys, you mentioned that, you know, the Rogues Gallery is the best Rogues Gallery out there.
Yeah.
But, and you also talked about JM, you know, writing Aunt May and really getting an understanding for Aunt May. As fans, we read your stories and we've read them over the years and we say, this one's a classic, or they really know this character, or they really define, you know, how this character is, and you've created characters along the way. But outside of what the fans' perceptions were there particular characters outside of Peter that you really enjoyed writing when you got to spend some time with on the page?
Oh yeah, almost all of them. Aunt May was great. Yeah, it was like there was this whole like generation of readers who were like, we had Aunt May, we want her dead, we get her ready. And whenever there was a story where she appeared to be dying, they'd go, yeah, yeah, she's kind of, oh, you saved her. Oh, I hate it. Really? Yeah. You'd be surprised. But you know, I'm writing it, and I'm going, why do they hate Aunt May? She's this sweet little lady. She's Peter's mother, for all intents and purposes. Like, you have a problem with your mother? Gee. So I always tried to emphasize how much he loves her in the thing, because that didn't always come out, especially in the years when there were 17 pages and there was this much Peter, that he really dotes on her, and he loves her because she raised him and all this. So Aunt May, Robbie Robertson, because Robbie was sort of the safeguard against Jonah, because Jonah would go off on a tirade and be, you know, apoplectic about things and ranting and giving everyone a hard time, and Robbie would be the calming influence. They'd go, okay, Jonah, that's fine. You know, Jonah would leave the room and he says, here's your check. You know, that's not to worry. Everything will be fine.
Freaking jokers.
As far as the villains go, the Vulture. Vulture is, I mean, everyone was, oh, we love the Green Goblin, we love Dr. Octopus, let's see him back again. You know, so Spider-Man can, you know, whip his goggles again, please. Because the Vulture, I always thought of, it was the perfect Spider-Man villain, because he was old age and treachery versus youth and enthusiasm. And I got to write the Vulture, like, three or four times over the course of the Spider-Man books that I did. And but the last one, I realized, the Vulture's been around all this time. He doesn't have an origin. We don't know where he came from. He just showed up one day, and he's flying around and stealing stuff and gets involved with Spider-Man. I'm going, I'm going to get him an origin. And as I was writing him, I was like, I really like this guy. He's terrible. And he does awful things, but I really like him. Yeah, I'm going to bring him back.
Yeah. Well, you have to. I mean, we have to love the villain.
Yeah.
We have to understand them. As the old villain doesn't walk around thinking they're a villain, first of all.
No.
And then the question I always bring to the table, I call the big why. All right, Craven, why is this guy running around in leopard skin pants with a rifle trying to shoot Spider-Man? What did his mother do to him when he was a kid? And I say, it sounds like a joke, but that's really the essential question in understanding these villains, you know? Because they're not villains in their own minds. They're people that have had these life experiences that brought them to that moment. So I've always enjoyed writing the villains for that reason, because you can always find, you can pry open their heads and find some interesting corner of their psyche that's never been explored before. And, you know, the fun with Craven was doing that. He was always like, oh, Craven, he's a B-level villain. And so the fun with that story was to make him really, really great and then kill him, and all the people that hated him before were like, why did you kill him? You know?
Exactly.
And in terms of the supporting cast, you know, Aunt May, obviously, because I was talking about that before, because I think she also, what I discovered, and it sounds funny that we discover this as we're writing the characters, because the characters tell us, you know, not because we're making it up, they really tell us. I discovered that Aunt May was really the source of Peter's strength. She was not this weak daughter and old lady. She had been through hell, and she was really, really strong. and a great character. And I loved writing the Peter Mary Jane wedding. I know there's a whole contingent that didn't like the marriage, but I really thought that that relationship was beautiful, and that became the source of his strength in so many ways. And it was a great place for me to sort of pour my own marriage in through Peter and Mary Jane. I've got a piece of artwork hanging in my house, a beautiful set of Yosemite piece of artwork, and there's a dialogue between Peter and MJ that I took right from my life, from words of my life, and I said to each other, you know.
Now so, I feel like crap.
So I really, really, really loved writing the two of them as a couple.
Yeah, I'm also a Vulture fan. Indeed, when I was doing 2099, the Vulture was the first 2099 Spider-Man villain, who was basically a 2099 version of the modern day. And I tried to put my own spin on him, which is why I made the Vulture a cannibal, because why the hell not?
Right.
You know? In terms of the supporting cast, I'm sorry? What is it? Oh, 15 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that someone who works at the convention, or they just randomly...
Yes, no, they're letting us know we have...
Oh, okay, that's fine. In terms of supporting cast, I really liked Betty Grant. I had a lot of fun writing her, because she's been through so freaking much that, to my mind, she's become like the Buffy of the Marvel Universe. Like, fine, bring it at me, bitches. I can take it. And I also found I really enjoyed J. Jonah Jameson.
I did.
I mean, Jameson is so much fun. He's a wonderful character. I mean, my favorite issue of Friendly Neighborhood Spider-Man, well, my last issue, was the Jonah story. And it arose because I was doing an online interview, and one fan said, the time when Jonah had launched a lawsuit against Peter Parker, who had revealed himself as Spider-Man. And a fan said, are you going to be resolving that story in which Jonah is suing Peter Parker? And I said, oh, I'm sure that Joe Straczynski is going to be resolving it. And then I thought about it, and I asked the editor if Joe's going to be resolving it. The editor said no. And I went, can I resolve it? And he said, sure, go ahead. And I wrote the issue with Jonah Jameson and Spider-Man and Peter Parker, and it was one of my favorite issues, if for no other reason than that it ended with Spider-Man swiping a bottle of wine from Robbie Robertson's house as Jonah was about to reach for it. Instead, he left a little note that says, you know, thanks a lot, courtesy, thanks for the wine, courtesy, your FNSM. And I had Jonah say, I hate that effing Spider-Man. And my editor said, there is no freaking way we're going to be able to get that print. And I said, well, try. And to my shock, it saw print just as I wrote it, because my attitude was, why not? I'm not the one who had him start calling himself Friendly Neighbor and Spider-Man, or sign things FNSM. He did that. I just took it to its logical extreme. And it saw print, and I was so happy with that. Yeah, but Jonah is really up there for me.
That took one I was going to, because oh. Jonah's my note. More than the, like, I love Spider-Man, but when I start, there's two characters in the Marvel Universe, and when I start writing, they just start speaking, and they just take you where they're going, and for me, that's Ben Grimm and J. Jonah Jameson.
Yes.
When I just start typing them, they just start going,
yeah.
And there'll be those moments when you're writing, and the characters, and it cracks you up. You're like, I did not see that coming. Oh my, Jonah's on a tear now. He's just and he's the most, he's my favorite character that Stan Lee ever helped co-create, because he there's so much life and energy to him. It's like you'll read a story like Frank Miller's Born Again, where he's suddenly being a crusading journalist. You're like, that's not him. I don't know who that guy is. That's not Jonah. Jonah's the guy writing like a 5-page editorial why his son is the greatest astronaut of all time and Spider-Man sucks. And it's so much fun to do Jonah. And for me on the villains, of course, it's got to be Doc Ock. I kind of spent so much time in his head. And he's a dark reflection of Peter. He's what Peter would have become. He's the scientist who buckled down. Like, when you read Peter in Amazing Fantasy 15, the jerk he is before that happens. Like, the rest of the world can go hang.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Screw him.
You know, I got these powers. I'm going to do this. That's Doc Ock. He's this pompous twit,
you know, he's, and he had his accident, and it took him a different way. I love writing that. I like, whenever I'm writing a villain, like, how do they relate to Peter Parker? How do they relate to the Spider-Man? But there's some that guys that are just fun. Like, when I write Mysterio, he's getting off on how big a con he could do. He could use his powers in such a different way, but there's, like, an ego there of, like, I'm going to make everyone think Martians landed. Yeah, and he's, whenever I
have, Orson Welles did it, I can do it better.
Better, yeah, and it's
right.
I love giving him henchmen because what he's treating them like the way you would at like a movie shoot. Like, okay, we're gonna set up, you know, pot number one, pot number two. Okay, are we ready? Is Spider-Man here yet? Okay, let's go. He's a showman.
And action.
Yeah, and that there's a fun in that. That, you know, he's not, like, we did a story where he made all the Magia, he made people think he was bringing people back from the dead. And what he really had was this animatronic Silverman that he's, like, back home. And he's loving that all these mobsters are thinking that he can raise the dead. Now we're really raising the dead in the current issue, so that's ruins it.
Well, I have hogged enough of these gentlemen's time. We have about 10 minutes left for questions. If you have a question, raise your hand, and I will point you out, and you can go. There you go, sir.
Yes, this is for all you guys. Basically, you know, in today's day and age, there's easily to get the backlash back. But, you know, as easy, you know, it wasn't as easy when you guys were first starting. Like, you had to actually write a letter. You know, now everything's feedback. So I'd like to hear all of you, like, the type of backlash you get, especially Dan. Because, you know, now, today's day, they just almost instant.
When we killed Peter Parker and the death threats came in, and for two different signings, one Marvel provided bodyguards and the other the NYPD did. Because, yeah, we had files and files. It was on CNN. They were, you know, getting death threats. And in the middle of all that, Jerry Conway reached out to me. It was the first time I talked to Jerry. And he said something to me, he's like, the thing that makes you different from any other Spider-Man writer is you are the Spider-Man writer during the age of social media. Yeah. That's what is making you more, and he's like, if I had thrown Gwen off the bridge, and there was Twitter, and there was Facebook, I don't even want to think about it. And it was like, it was really nice he did that he reached out, and then we've been talking ever since, it was really great.
I've gotten backlash for things, but never anything of Spider-Man related. I mean, I got backlash when I had Shatterstar and Richter come out, when I killed off Jim Wilson. You know, I've gotten backlash for things. I did get backlash to a speech I wrote for Jonah Jameson, but it was in the pages of X-Factor when he was mayor. So, no, nothing ever Spidey related. Maybe I should be working harder.
Yeah, I haven't had very many negative experiences on social media at all. In fact, 99% of my experiences have been really, really good and really, really positive. And the only time I got anything even remotely like a death threat was completely ridiculous, actually, because it was a 5-page preview. It wasn't Spider-Man, of some book that was coming out, and someone read the 5-page preview and decided that I should die for that reason. And it was like almost like a what-if kind of story, but that's not the point. The point was, my first reaction was like, I'm going to report this guy, I'm gonna block him on Twitter and all this stuff, and then I thought, what if I reach out to this guy? So I actually did that, and I just started talking to him. By the time we were done talking, he had apologized for what he said. The problem with social media is that everything is instant. So someone gets pissed off, and the first thought that comes into their head goes out through the keyboard. And the first thought that often comes into our heads is not always such a great thought, you know? But the thing I really enjoy about it, that it really allows for a really great communication and a great connection that, you know, most of us spend our time alone in a room with our imaginary friends. So it's nice to be able to connect with people that are reading and appreciating our story. So, like I said, 99% of my experience has been very positive.
Even like during the most volatile times of like when that stuff was going on, when people would approach me with a social media attitude in the real world, it diffuses in a second when you just start talking with them.
Right.
And my problem is there's so much of that. Right. When I try your approach, it's like rolling the dice. It works once, then the other 9 times it doesn't. And then it builds up and builds up, and then you go,
Yeah, I'm sort of the odd man out here in that I don't really do social media. On my email, if you ever read an email from me, you'll notice a little, you know, signature line that says, you know, I am not on Facebook, I am not on MySpace. I am not LinkedIn. I do not tweet. You're getting an email from me. Isn't that enough? But it didn't exist when I was doing most of my writing, and when I write stuff now, I don't pay attention to it, so it doesn't affect me much. When I was writing, we got letters, postcards, whatever. And the frustrating thing was putting together the letters pages, because letters would trickle in on an issue, and it's due. And, okay, I put together the letters page, and the next day, there's a flood of letters. Great letters. So I just started advancing things, because we'd usually have an issue, and you would have the letters from four issues before. So I just held some back and did the issues from five issues before, and suddenly we had great letters in the letters page. It just will extend a little bit.
Yep. I saw you had a question right there. Yep.
This is for Jim Person, the follow-up for the first of the BS. Everything we've seen in the movies and on TV, one thing we haven't and might not ever is a DC Marvel crossover. What was it like doing Disordered Minds? And if you guys read it, your thoughts on how that came out?
Oh, okay. I did. It's JM, so there's no. People always project an I in the middle until they turn me into Jim, which is fine. It's okay. I get so many to get letters.
Dear Jim.
Well, Jim should have actually just walked in the back.
Oh.
So, but it's a trick of the eye. They see the dot and they make it a Jim. I actually got to do the DC and the Marvel ones. So I did Spider-Man for DC and Spider-Man Batman for Marvel, which was really, really fun. I enjoyed both those tremendously. I don't have any profound feelings about it or deep insights, just that I was really honored that I got to do both of them for both companies, and I really, really had a great time with it.
I did a big crossover series called Marvel vs. DC. It was me and Ron Mars, and I have to say that when I got the four of us, myself, Ron Mars, Mark Grunewald, and Mike Carlin, who were the editors, got together at Mark's apartment in Manhattan. And that was really one of the greatest creative experiences I've ever undergone. Sitting there as we were working out the overall arc of the storyline and deciding who was going to win which fights and which fights we were going to leave for the fans to decide and working it all out. I mean, it was a tremendously entertaining endeavor. And I still remember when Ron and I tried to write the first issue together, and it didn't work at all. And Mark and Mike said, this issue is not working. I talked to Ron, and I said, look, our styles are too different. Maybe what we should do is I'll write two entire issues, and you write two entire issues. And Ron said, which ones do you want to write? And I said, I'd like to write issues two and four. And Ron said, are you kidding? And I said, what? And he said, I want to do issues one and three. And I said, well, this is going to work out. I mean, I wanted to do issue two because that was going to have the fights that we had decided on. And I wanted to do issue four because that would wrap it all up. I had no interest in issue one because that was primarily introduction stuff. And issue three was going to be the one where the fans decided who was going to win the fights. Mm-hmm. And I had no interest in doing that because I was reasonably sure the fans would get some stuff wrong, which they did. Honestly, I'm sorry, Wolverine does not beat Lobo. I mean, he just doesn't. He's Lobo.
No. Anyone can win any fight. It's the context.
Wolverine doesn't beat Lobo. He doesn't beat Lobo.
Squirrel Girl could beat Wolverine.
Well, Squirrel Girl could beat anybody, but that's a whole different story.
But I just had, but Ron wanted to do issues one and three because issue number one was issue number one, and he wanted to do the ones where the fans figured it out. And my attitude was Zyga's in, So, that was really just an incredibly entertaining creative endeavor. I love doing that. I really wish that the world existed right now where Marvel and DC could continue to do crossovers, because I think that would be tremendously entertaining, but the way the companies are at this point, it's just not going to happen.
Well, as we do wrap up, because we have to make way for the next panel here, I do want to thank...
What's the next panel?
The next panel is...
Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine.
Oh, forget that.
Oh, screw it. It's been off the air for like 15 years.
But I do want to say, and I think I speak for every Spidey fan in the room, that for a character that means so much to all of us that we have read, if not continuously through, then certainly on and off throughout the years and have our favorite writers and our favorite moments, thank you for everything that you have brought to the legacy of Spider-Man. Thank you for your time on all of the different books that you've worked on, because a lot of those moments mean the world to us and are very reflective of moments in our lives as well. So thank you for being here. Thanks for the panel. And thanks for the work that you do.
No problem.